From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the hum of Wall Street, with the Dow surging past 18,000 this morning for the first time ever on the strength of a better estimate of GDP. The United States just completed its fastest growing quarter since 2003. Meanwhile, oil prices remain low. The Russian economy is in a bit of trouble. The ruble has crashed, and we're wondering if it's stabilizing now. All of a sudden, Vladimir Putin doesn't look like quite the hero his people thought he might be a few months ago. This hour, we try to make sense of the year in money and try to get a look at what might be coming in 2015. My guests for the hour are Randy Stone, professor of political science, director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Randy, always nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Amit Badibial is a professor of economics at RIT and was in Russia as recently as August, right?
That's right.
Nice to have you. And Jim Englert is here from High Falls Advisors, from right around the corner. Jim, nice to see you.
Nice to be here, Evan.
All right. I will start with the question of the Dow at 18,000 and what we are to make of it. I mean, it's very easy for us to get overly hung up on benchmarks, et cetera, but it only took 6 months for the Dow to go from 17 to 18,000. It only took 7 months prior to that to go from 16 to 17. I'll start with you, Jim, at High Falls Advisors. Are you assuming there's a correction coming, or are we at a point now where the economy feels healthy and that even if a correction is a natural course, it's not imminent anytime soon?
Well, I don't think that that it is coming anytime soon. It is going to come some. The market can't continually just continue
in perpetuity.
Go
it
up
can't
straight.
That would be wonderful.
It doesn't happen that way. And sometimes, actually, one of the things that I've noticed this year is small company stocks actually looking at the Russell 2000 to represent that. Actually, the Russell 2000. Continued to go just sideways all this year, and I believe that if anybody is actually thinking about next year, that small company stocks might do a little bit better than they did this year, and I wouldn't be surprised to see large company stocks actually do something similar that small company stocks did this year. So to kind of go actually sideways actually for an actual period of time.
Professor Badibial, growth, GDP at 5%, that looks like a very healthy number. Obviously, the market is responding well to that today. What do the indicators say to you?
Well, a couple of things. I think the GDP numbers are very positive for the American economy. I think our economy hasn't grown as fast in the past 10-plus years, so that's a very welcome number. And the Dow being up is also good news, but I think we have to remember two things. One is, comparing internationally, we're doing much better relative to our European peers, no question about that, and even some of our Asian peers. But within the United States, even though the Dow is up, a lot of people aren't particularly savory about the future prospects about the American economy, is because what they're not seeing is wage growth. Wages are still pretty much stuck, or they're growing very, very slowly. So from the standpoint of individual Americans, they aren't seeing the kind of wage growth that you would typically associate with a booming economy. And as long as that continues to persist, this lack of upward movement in wages, the Dow going up itself isn't going to make a whole lot of difference from the standpoint of individual Americans.
And we can't spend the entire hour on policy and how to sort of generate income equality, if that's a goal. And again, there are plenty who say it's a natural function of capitalism and the free market that maybe income equality exists. But income inequality is at the widest point we've seen it in a long time, right? I mean, despite the efforts of President Obama and his peers in the Democratic Party, income inequality remains a wide gap, isn't it?
That is true. I mean, income inequality is almost at historic highs, and that's probably an explanation as to why the French economist Thomas Piketty's book about income inequality was so popular and did so well in terms of generating mass sales, despite the fact that it's a densely written economics book. A lot of people agree that income inequality is unacceptably high. Not that it's just high, it's unacceptably high, and that policymakers not only in Washington but across the board need to do something about it.
And now we look at what's going on, as you mentioned, Professor Badibial, relative around the world and particularly in Russia. And Professor Badabiyal was in Russia in August. Randy Stone, we've been talking to you throughout the year about various affairs there, going back to last winter and looking at Crimea. And we talked last winter, almost a year ago, about the sanctions that the United States was putting in place and the question of if they would have an impact. Is there any question now that they're having an impact?
I don't think there's any question. I think that what is striking is that they've had more impact than anyone, including in the administration, expected. We had some meetings last week, a group of Russian and Americans who meet twice a year to discuss foreign policy, had some meetings in Washington with members of the administration, and they were quite frank with us that they were surprised at how effective the sanctions had been, because there's a careful balancing game to be done here. They're trying to calibrate the sanctions. They were never designed to be maximally effective. We've held most of our powder dry. And these very targeted sanctions have nevertheless had a significant effect in spooking foreign investors, which are a major source of foreign exchange for Russia, spooking domestic holders of capital who have been engaging in large capital flight. And this has put a lot of pressure on the ruble. So by no means would I say that the sanctions are responsible for all of Russia's current economic woes. The fact that a barrel of oil has dropped from $115 in June to $61 now is responsible for a lot of Russia's problems. But because of the sanctions, Russian banks have nowhere to go. Right. The Russian banking system is highly mortgaged, leveraged in dollars, and they need to refinance that debt. Russian companies owe about $700 billion, which they cannot reborrow. Right. So this creates a lot of problems. And the sanctions have cut them off from outside finance.
If you have questions for our panel as we talk the year in money 2014, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Russia's economic minister, Alexei Ulyakayev, recently said that, yeah, it's a perfect storm. It's not just sanctions. But the question now is, as we look at the ruble, which was crashing, how do you know when it's stabilized? And frankly, the follow-up to that, Randy, is what does this administration hope for? You're indicating that we wanted to throw them a punch, but you don't want to knock them out necessarily. There are strategic reasons to punch and not try to knock out. And what's the concern for us if Russia goes through a significant downturn and it lasts for some time?
Right. Well, there are economic reasons for restraint, and then there are diplomatic strategic reasons for restraint. Economically, Russia, we used to say Russia had an economy of $2 trillion, right? Now that the ruble is up, has dropped so much, it looks more like a $1 trillion economy in dollar terms. The contraction of the Russian economy has severe consequences for its trading partners, particularly in Europe. Europeans export about $116 billion per year to Russia, and that export is drying up. So that will hurt Russia. That will hurt Europe. Then, as the European economy slows down, that has an effect on the American economy as well. So there are economic reasons that you don't want to start with a knockout punch. But diplomatically, there are also reasons for restraint. You want to signal two things with these sanctions. One is resolve. Right, that the Western alliance stands firm, that the United States remains committed to the defense of its NATO allies, including Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, who are former republics of the former Soviet Union, who are now members of NATO, and Poland and the other states sort of in the front line. But you also want to signal restraint, that the United States was not, in fact, behind the events that led to the fall of Viktor Yanukovych, and that the United States does not have aggressive designs to overturn the status quo in the former Soviet Union. Because when Russia feels boxed into a corner, it starts to act more extreme.
And so when you met in Washington with the group and you're talking to members of the administration, is there concern that the sanctions this year have had too sharp an effect? And is there going to be sort of a gearing back?
Well, I would say actually that the members of the administration were quite satisfied with the effect that they've had, and felt that this is perhaps a little sooner than they'd expected to have this much effect. But they're very satisfied that very targeted, narrow sanctions have nonetheless been very potent.
And for those of us, I should say, I try to sort of humbly say, when it comes to the package of sanctions, many of us don't know what the actual sanctions are, but it's easy for the media to get sort of cynical or view them as sort of ineffective. And this has probably been a very good lesson for all of us this year, that sanctions can have real teeth and can have impact. And now the question turns to what the impact for Vladimir Putin is. I mean, in a moment, I want to hear from Professor Badabial what it was like in August versus here in December. He must be seeing his fortunes change pretty sharply.
That's right. Well, Putin's popularity is still sky high.
Even today. Will that change if this economic climate doesn't improve?
Usually authoritarian leaders who have bad economic performance become less popular.
And I think or any leader when they write.
I think it's safe to assume that over the medium to long term, this will have potent effects. So far, Putin is seen by Russians as the one who saved their economy when it was in a tailspin. He came to office in 2000. They were still just beginning to recover from the 1998 financial crisis. He benefited from the fact that the ruble dropped significantly in value in 1998 and then had strong trade surpluses for a number of years. He's popular. He also is credited with having restored order in the major cities. Organized crime and crime generally is as much reduced from what it was, and having restored Russia to the status of a great power, not a superpower, but at least a power to be taken seriously. And Russians value that and feel a certain nostalgia for the fact that they used to walk a little taller than they did in the 1990s. And he has lots of reasons to be popular, but many of these are based on economic success.
And we could have short careers in predictions, as we know. We've talked this year about how unpredictable some of his actions were, particularly because you've made the point that Crimea was always sort of the low-hanging fruit that everyone knew if Vladimir Putin chose to sort of access it, he could do it, but that threat always hung in the air. And when he actually did it, you remove sort of an easy bit of leverage. So the question is, if the economic situation in Russia continues to be a crisis and it lasts for some time, are we concerned that he could take a fresh look at Eastern Ukraine or doing something else that would be considered sort of troublesome, but also maybe to bolster or to change the conversation or to change his own image with his people?
Yes. And when pushed into a corner, dictators sometimes escalate, right? The classic case of that is the war between Argentina and Great Britain over the Falklands Islands, right, where Argentina was in an economic crisis, chose to start this conflict, many believe, in order to distract attention from domestic economic difficulties at home. Political scientists are divided about this, but most international relations experts don't put a lot of weight on this so-called diversionary war hypothesis. It seems that there aren't really very many cases that look like that. It doesn't show up in the quantitative analyses of why wars begin, but it's out there as a hypothesis. People in Washington are expecting now is that now that he's discovered that the sanctions really are effective and that the West has been much more cohesive than was expected, that if anything, Angela Merkel's recent statements have been tougher than either the U.S. administration or the Russians were expecting, suggests that he has every reason to try to de-escalate. And the recent statements have all been in that direction. They've been moving back. The current ceasefire has basically held for the last couple of weeks, although apparently some shelling happened yesterday. There's Russian officials have been making statements where they have been signaling willingness to compromise. And Putin, in his three-hour tirade last Thursday, and he does a once a year open mic event with the media. And he held forth for 3 hours, and there were certain key words that he didn't use. Right, he didn't use the word fascists, which the Russians have been using to describe the Ukrainian leadership, and he didn't use the word Novorossiya, right, which is the Catherine the Great era term for sort of the eastern and southern part of Ukraine, which he had revived in an effort to kind of show that, well, we have geopolitical designs here. And he didn't mention that over the course of 3 hours. So we see that as a positive sign.
He's been chastened in a little bit there, in other words, yeah.
We hope so, and it seems to look that way.
Professor Badabial, Andrew Sullivan Online loves to write about President Obama's long game, that he's often playing a longer game than the media can see, and that he has written recently that the sanctions in Russia are an indication that this administration understood the long game and that this is all part of it, and that maybe the year opens and Vladimir Putin looks like a hero to his people, and you know, there's a debate in the American media and if this administration is doing enough for taking the right approach, and the year is closing with Vladimir Putin chastened and revising his vocabulary and the Russian economy struggling. You were there in August. What was the climate like in August?
Well, in August, it was much better than what it is right now. Putin's popularity, as has just been mentioned, was very, very high. People were unsurprised or unworried about any significant negative aspects to the economy. To give you a flavor for what the ruble was, as best as I can recall, during that time, the ruble was 32 to a dollar. Okay. So it sank below 80 briefly, then stabilized at about 61, and I think now is at 56.
Yeah, 55 yesterday. Yeah,
55 yesterday. So they were, we were not seeing the kinds of actions that we have now been seeing in Moscow, where people are running to stores to buy furniture, cars, and things of that sort to get rid of their rubles, because their rubles were losing value very, very quickly. And in fact, and there are reports of some shops repricing their merchandise on an everyday basis. Very, very alarming sign for those of us who worried about inflation and know, for instance, what happened in Weimar Germany when inflation was so high that prices were in fact being changed by the minute. So in to put it briefly, the concerns were nothing like what they are right now. People weren't really worried about things escalating dramatically, either on the war foot or the economy de-escalating. But things are very much different now than they were in August.
Our panel is talking about the year in money. Randy Stone from the University of Rochester. Amit Badabial, a professor of economics at RIT. And Jim Englert from High Falls Advisors. And Jim, I wonder when you, if your clients come to you and are concerned, I say concerned about oil prices. It's interesting. When oil prices are high, everyone is complaining. Now that oil prices are low, we've miraculously found ways to complain. We find ways to ascribe blame and credit to presidents who probably have very little to do with oil prices. But what do you say to your clients about the possible impact of oil at what, 55, 60? Is it 60, $60 a barrel?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Right around $60.
$61 is what I saw.
Do you have expectations for that changing in the new year?
Actually, our clients really are actually very happy about that. But it is because they pay less at the gas pump. I'm not sure that actually that they're thinking an awful lot about the economics of it.
They're happy to see where the Dow is, et cetera.
Absolutely. They're just happy looking at the broader indexes and what they're doing. But, you know, to actually focus on actually energy and things like that, they really don't, other than the fact that they have more to spend now.
Are there sectors that you like to be positioned in? Energy, for an example.
Right now, energy probably is not good. It hasn't been good for probably 3 months or so. if there's sectors, it's more information technology, it's biotechnology, that type of thing, actually has been very, very strong for several months now.
And I imagine biotechnology is not going anywhere for the long term, but what about alternative forms of energy going forward? I mean, obviously, we're fixated on the price of oil and it has such an impact, but what about alternative forms of energy?
Well, actually, right now, if you look at actually the relative strength of different actual sectors of the economy, unfortunately, natural resources really are not really performing very high. If you compare it to anything. If you look at energy today, that's not performing very high. If you look at it actually based on its actual relative strength to the total stock market. I think ultimately, last year at this time, a lot of the natural resources were actually much higher, mm-hmm. and it is going through different cycles right now, and none of them are performing very well mm-hmm. at this point.
So, professors, when it comes to what's driving the price of oil, demand, worldwide demand.
I would argue it's mainly worldwide demand is down. Chinese economy is not growing quite as fast as it was in the past. The European economy is growing more slowly. And there also were a number of oil development projects that came online in the last year or so. Right? So there is also excess supply. But I think it's mostly a demand story.
Yeah, I would agree. It's the combination of both of those things. That's what's really exerting the double whammy, because if demand were constant and it was just excess supply, that would have a downward impact on the price of oil. But what we're seeing now is reduced demand and excess supply, both of which are exerting a really negative impact on the price of oil. So both those forces collectively is what accounts for the price of oil today.
And you see in the media, we have no idea what to root for. Everyone was complaining about high gasoline. Not everybody was complaining about high gasoline prices. In fact, we've talked to economist Kent Gardner and others who indicate that if you really want to impact behavior and fossil fuel consumption, even a more strident gas tax might be called for. But for those who were complaining about, say, gas prices, et cetera, you could complain about the high cost of oil. And now there's concern. Professor Badabial, are you concerned about oil where it is?
Well, that depends on which hat you wear. Mm-hmm. As a consumer, you're thrilled. As Jim just pointed out, we all fill up gas and we see the low prices, and that's a great thing. It gives us more discretionary income. So wearing your consumer hat, it's a bad idea. Very good idea. But of course, if you happen to work in the energy sector and you have stocks invested in energy, or I invested in energy in general, then you look at it wearing your supplier hat. And with the supplier hat, things are not as rosy as they were before. And the worst thing is it doesn't look like they're going to get rosy anytime soon.
Randy, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Professor.
No, I was just going to say, so it's very much a function of perspective, whose perspective one looks at the question from.
And they're probably going to stay in the neighborhood of where they are for a while. Are we going to see triple-digit oil prices? Is there any reason to suspect that's coming?
Well, I'm not, I have no special expertise in the oil market. I just point out that one other downside to the low oil price is that it reduces incentives for conservation and for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And
yeah.
So that we were hoping with the high oil price and the resurgence of alternative energy sources that we might be able to make some progress in reducing greenhouse emissions. And if this oil price remains low for very long, we're not going to.
And again, within Europe, Russia is relying on this issue to change their economic fortunes. That's a huge piece of their pie, isn't it?
It's absolutely critical to Russia. It's hard to see how they get out of the current economic crisis without the oil price dramatically improving. Of course, it's a moving target. What there was an interesting graphic in I think it was the New York Times about the level of the oil price that was needed by various countries to balance their budgets. Right, and Russia had one of the higher ones, but because of the dramatic devaluation that's occurred, the oil price that they need to actually balance their budget is a lot lower than it was. All right, so Truman used to say, you know, give me a one-handed economist, right? Because economists always say, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, and it's true. Everything in economics has a silver lining and a hidden cost to it, and this is no exception.
All right, go ahead. I'd like to add a point, if I may. We've talked about sanctions and we've talked about the price of oil being low. But a structural problem with the Russian economy, which is, I would argue, from a long-run perspective, the single biggest cause of many of their problems, is that their economy is highly non-diversified and extremely dependent on natural resources, oil and natural gas in particular. Now, Putin recognizes this, and he's mentioned this several times, including probably at his three-hour tirade last week, that their economy is so non-diversified. So that's the economic equivalent of putting all your eggs in one basket. So if the basket gets rattled, most or all of your eggs might crack or break. And they have nothing else to do because oil and natural gas generate 3/4 of their export revenues. And they're really in trouble if the price is low. There's nothing else in the economy that they can point to which would generate significant export revenues.
We're talking a year in money, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Stephen and JT, we're going to get your questions answered here with our panel talking about the various issues impacting, well, the markets today and money around the world. Jim Englert is here from High Falls Advisor, High Falls Advisors. I'm at Bada Bialz, a professor of economics at RIT, and Randy Stone, the professor of political science and director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Some of your questions answered next right here on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 in Rochester, and seeing a number of comments on Twitter, many of them related to the Dow. Stephen on Twitter saying the Dow is 18,000, question mark. Why does it feel that that has no impact on most of us? Jim, what do you make of that?
Well, actually, an awful lot of our clients are retired, and I think an awful lot of people are looking actually for actually income in a more secure way than the stock market, and it used to be, you know, not that long ago, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you could have interest rates in a bank account at approximately 2, 2.5%, 3%. However, today it's less than 1% right across the board, and it has caused, I believe, it's caused a lot of people to go into the stock market that probably are not very comfortable with that, but it's the only alternative that they have. So it's an interesting time because of that.
Professor Bada Bialz, apparently people are not feeling, again, the impact of what looks like a, a successful or a strong market from a lot of the optics.
That's right. And I would underscore the point that I alluded to a couple minutes ago. The reason why that's happening is that when they look at the situation from their own personal circumstance, what they're worried about is their income, their discretionary income. And if there's little or no wage growth, and this is the important point that I would like to emphasize, whether the Dow is in the stratosphere makes little difference to their daily lives. And that's what we're seeing right now. So what we need is a sustained period of wage growth, which positively affects the pocketbooks and incomes of folks at large. And then they're going to be excited about the economy doing well in general.
What can we look for that will change the income inequality or wage growth situation, Professor?
Nothing in the immediate future,
yeah.
But the government definitely can take certain steps to ameliorate the problem, and there's talk about that. So, for instance, one way in which you might do that is attempt to reduce the burden of people that they encounter when they send kids to college. I mean, college education is extremely expensive. It's almost beyond the reach of a lot of people. So any steps that the government can take in that direction would definitely be a positive impact, have a positive impact on people's lives.
All right, I see the phone ringing again. Let me get back to some of the comments from our audience. This is John in the city of Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I was just calling about, income inequality as an example. I think the economic strategy of this administration, I think, has contributed to it. They seem to be using a Keynesian economic theory to promote vitality, and I think it's backfiring on them. We've got a national debt right now, I think exceeds $18 trillion, I think what we need to do, and I'd be curious to see what your economics professors say about this, is to kind of turn it around, get out of the Keynesian philosophy and move to more of a supply-side economics. So move resources from government, reduce government spending from the standpoint of bureaucracy and that type of thing, try to shift those resources into the hands of the private sector through tax cuts, et cetera, because the government is showing itself to be very inefficient, and I think is contributing to this economic malaise. And
well, John, let me ask you a quick question before I kick it over to our panel here. Again, you're using the term Keynesian. In 2008, everyone was a Keynesian. Even Republicans favored large stimulus packages. So if you want to talk about Keynesian economics during crisis, everyone was a Keynesian in 2008.
We're out of the crisis.
I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah,
know
I
if
agree.
You're saying Keynesian
me, the
now.
Republicans, George Bush, in fact, a lot of the conservatives rallied against George Bush with his spending. And he went along with the Democrats, I think, in part to appease them because of the Iraq war. So the Republicans are almost as much as fault as the Democrats. Not quite, but Reagan, I think Reagan would have been more successful in the 1980s if Tip O'Neill wasn't controlling the House of Representatives, and later the Senate went to the Democrats. So Reagan couldn't do anything to reduce government spending and eliminate these bureaucracies like the Department of Energy and reduce the Department of Education, that type of thing. Reagan would have been very successful if he had a Republican Congress, and really got out of Keynesian and gone to supply-side economics.
All right, well, let me ask, John, thanks for the call. Let me ask our panel. I'll start with Professor Badabiel. Are we overusing the term Keynesian? Let's start with a brief definition, how you define it, and then the question of whether if we're in a sort of a Keynesian age right now.
Right. So, excuse me. So the idea goes back roughly to the early 1930s when John Maynard Keynes, in his most famous book, argued during and the aftermath of the Great Depression in the United States, that when an economy is in that kind of a situation where there's, from his perspective, the significant problem was lack of demand. Lack of demand in the economy, lack of aggregate demand. The way to deal with such a problem was to stimulate the economy. And the single biggest stimulator of the economy would typically be Uncle Sam. So that's the basic Keynesian idea, which governments over time have tried to follow in one way, shape, or form. Now, in this particular context, I agree with the caller that definitely I'm all for eliminating government waste. There's no question about that. However, Barack Obama came into a rather unusual set of circumstances in his first term when he was inaugurated president. At that time, if he had not made the very large infusions of cash that he did make to bail out, for instance, Detroit, Detroit would be nowhere near what it is, and the big three automakers would not be where they are right now. There's no question about that. More generally, the debate that the caller is alluding to is, in these kinds of scenarios, should we follow a policy of austerity, which has been followed by some governments? The most notable example is Germany in Europe. Or should we be attempting to stimulate the economy and stimulating aggregate, aggregate demand a la Keynes? And this is a perspective on which economists differ. But I think it's fair to say that those countries that have attempted to broadly mimic what Germany has done have not done very well. And if you look at how the European economies are doing generally and how the American economy is doing right now, there is a difference. The Europeans are doing far worse than the United States is doing in general. So I would disagree with the caller that supply-side policies are what's called for. And yes, it's true that the government cannot forever be bailing entities out of the economy. But the government bailouts of the auto industry have in general produced profits for the government, which ultimately means the American taxpayer. And all of the evidence that I have read suggests that stimulating the economy is a better idea when it's in dire straits rather than playing austerity a la Angela Merkel.
Yeah, I think part of what John is indicating is that, okay, if we were all Keynesians in 2008, aren't times better now? The Dow's at 18,000, GDP at 5%. Do we need a Keynesian approach anymore? Can't we throttle it back? And I think that's more of what I'm hearing from John. And what you're indicating is his waste may be another man's, you know, necessary spending.
That's true. I mean, you look at the midterm elections, right? The Democrats could have touted the fact that the economy is much better than it actually was in 2008. And it is. By most objective measures, it is. But yet they got shellacked in the midterm polls. Why? One big reason is because individuals aren't seeing any benefits in their own personal lives, even though the Dow is in the stratosphere, relatively speaking.
And John is saying he thinks President Obama has made income inequality worse through his policies.
Well, I don't see how.
Has he made it better?
Well, he's not had much of a positive impact thus far because he hasn't been able to follow through on many of his policies. But for instance, Obamacare is, I think, going to have a positive impact on reducing income inequality once it's up and running properly.
All right, we got Mike in Livonia, who is more on John's side here. Go ahead, Mike. Are you there, Mike?
I appreciated the previous caller who was talking about supply side. And I think what gets lost in the debate is that people don't understand what supply side really entails because how involved and complex the economy is. I mean, labor is a demand. And people that, you know, need to hire people have a demand for cheaper labor. And when we make labor so expensive by increasing minimum wage, by increasing gasoline taxes, by constantly causing the cost to do things to be more because of government, you take away from true supply-side help. Saying there's austere or Keynesian is really two false choices because we can't just keep making government bigger. We all know that's silly. So Keynesianism sounds crazy when you take it to the extreme. We need a little bit when there's a crisis, granted. But if you don't give the power back to the supply-side equation, which is supply the people with, you know, ample labor, supply the people with ample goods and services, supply the people with ample resources, we stop looking at that way from that argument, and everything gets clouded, and nothing seems to change. And supply side really is, you know, the way it's worked the best, and everybody seems to overlook it. But The Way the World Works, a book by Jude Wininsky that I encourage everybody to read. It's black and white.
All right,
in
Mike,
all the gray areas.
All right, Mike, let me get a response in here. Thanks for the call, Mike.
Well, one of the reasons why supply side is relatively unpopular and very few people know about it is because it doesn't work. That's why it's unpopular and relatively unknown, not because it has had an amazing track record of booming success. I agree with the caller that in general, from the perspective of small businesses, we should certainly attempt to create circumstances so that there are not bottlenecks and they're able to pursue their hiring decisions relatively unfettered. But the caller did refer to the gasoline tax. there has not been any rising gasoline taxes in the United States. And if you're talking about high gasoline taxes, ours are very, very low relative to what they are in pretty much every industrial nation of the world. So our gasoline taxes, if any, should be higher than they are, not lower.
Back to the phones. David in the city wants to talk about Russia. Go ahead, David.
Yes. Are there any reporters at all in Russia who tell the Russian people of that the Malaysian airliner was downed by Russia, and also many statements by Putin that Russia has no involvement in Ukraine? Those are complete falsehoods. Isn't there anybody in Russia who can report those things to the Russian people?
Professor Stone?
Well, absolutely. It's interesting. When we meet with our Russian colleagues, they are very well informed, very aware of Western news outlets, and aware that their government is being, frankly, mendacious, right? That Russia, the Russian official position lied about the involvement in Crimea until everything was mopped up, and then Putin said, "Well, yes, of course we were there." They lied and continue to lie about their involvement in eastern Ukraine, and the American government is quite aware that there are large numbers of Russian tanks, artillery pieces, anti-aircraft weapons, and these are not Russian volunteers. These are the Russian army that's occupying territory in the Donetsk and Lugansk regions. In August, it looked briefly like the Ukrainian army, as weak as it was going to put an end to the insurgency in eastern Ukraine. And because they were fighting irregulars and volunteers. And the Russians had pulled out most of their top people just shortly before. Then their fortunes dramatically reversed. Of course, the only reason that could happen was because the Russian army moved in, and the Ukrainian army is no match for the Russian army. So, yes, there's been a systematic unwillingness to acknowledge the true state of affairs on the ground. This has a broader consequence. It's not just a matter of disputes about particular facts, right? This has poisoned the diplomatic atmosphere between Russia and the West, and I think this, more than anything else, more than actually the military involvement itself, is what has infuriated Angela Merkel and the European leaders, and has led to a circling of the wagons. If I could just say one thing about in response to the previous callers, I would agree with Mike in one respect, that there is an important supply side factor here, which is labor. And the reason that the U.S. economy performs in the long term considerably better than the European economies is that it's more open to the immigration of labor, and that reforming immigration is the biggest supply side reform that we could make that would really improve U.S. economic performance.
Professor Badibi, I'll agree.
Oh, that's absolutely true. In fact, I've argued for that in several opinion articles, and the Senate version of the bill that did pass the Senate but made no progress in the House, in fact, had some very good things. So, for instance, in one sentence, basically, we need to get away from our immigration policy, which is, generally speaking, based on the reunification of families, to adopt a strategic perspective where we basically give first advantage to those people who are trained, preferably at the master's and doctoral level, in the fields that we have shortages, and give those people the first pass at staying in our economy, as staying in the United States on a long-term basis.
Keith, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Keith.
Yes. Co-worker and I were talking last week, and one of the things that came out of that conversation was that no one thinks about your money like you do personally. So as I've been listening to the conversation, we've talked about, you know, the Keynesian philosophy, supply side economics, the global oil prices, et cetera, et cetera. So if an individual, a professional who is looking to make themselves more secure financially, and better have a better understanding of some of the things, if not all of the things that you've discussed. What resources are available here locally that an individual can, you know, avail themselves to, where they can educate themselves, so that if I chose to, you know, engage with a certified financial planner or someone of that nature, that I can be informed and be able to tie all this information that you're speaking of to my personal life and my family's life, and see how different events that take place across around the world, how they affect me, and the things that I can do to make a positive change for me personally.
Keith, thanks for the call. I'll start with Jim from High Falls Advisors. You want to become more literate in how events impact people. How do you do it?
I think it is important to engage an actual professional who is a certified financial planner. Unfortunately, a lot of the things that we've talked about today are things that are not really in our control. And it's things I think that's important to be in tune to, that you actually do understand what's going on actually all over the globe. I think that's important. But, the approach that I take as a certified financial planner is to look at the individual's actual circumstances and actually to work with them individually, find out actually what they are about, and to try as best as we can to actually fit that individual into some of these global issues that unfortunately we don't have control.
We don't always control, and some of them it will impact our individual portfolios. Some of them will not. And,
that's correct.
And Professor Badabial, I think his question's a good one, though. I mean, we want to stay more literate with what's going on in the world.
Absolutely, no question. So I would second what Jim just said. Definitely rely on a trustworthy, I repeat, trustworthy, because there are, less than savory people out there masquerading as financial planners, a trustworthy financial planner to get your own house in order. But beyond that, I think the single best policy is to rely on yourself. There are lots of news media sources in print and broadcast media which you can read on a regular basis to get a good sense for what's happening in the macro economy, not just internationally, but within the United States. So for instance, CNN Money would be a good site to go and look at what kinds of articles and news stories are being published there on a regular basis. Bloomberg News is another such source that one could aspire to if one is interested in somewhat more different perspective, but nonetheless a very good one. The Economist is a periodical that I read regularly for information for a non-U.S. perspective on world affairs. The New York Times is, of course, another very good place. And programs such as the one that you're holding, these are all based on informing people with the aim of getting people to have a greater control over their lives. So there is a multiplicity of avenues that one can seek.
All right, let me grab one more quick call here, and then we'll try to wrap things up as we look at the year in money. This is Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, hi. Real quick, I think the arguments that we have on this, if you don't start with three facts, number one, that we have an economy that is not a totally capitalist economy. People always argue, we're capitalism. We're very much a hybrid. And I think the argument of capitalism versus socialism is a red herring, because neither one of them have ever succeeded in their purest form. Number two is that we have a society that there will always be poor. I don't care what you do, there will always be poor. So the question really is, if there is poor, as a civilized society, what are you willing to do to help them? Because many of the arguments that we hear is that, well, if everybody just pulls themselves up by the bootstraps, everything will be fine. But that's a false argument and a false point. And so I just want to get their view on those two things.
Thank you, Rich. Thoughts around the room? Randy, brief response there.
Well, it's absolutely right that we live in a mixed economy. I don't have the figure on the top of my head, but the U.S. government spends a substantial portion of our GDP, much smaller than in most other advanced industrial countries. The government is responsible for a lot of regulation, which is actually essential to the financial, the functioning of our financial markets and effective public policies. And the even centrally planned economies that that Rich alluded to, which aspired to eliminate the market, weren't able to do without the market entirely. Right there. So there's always various kinds of mixtures.
Yeah, and I think to some degree it doesn't help the conversation when every time we talk about a tax or a higher tax on this, et cetera, you get a refrain of socialism, et cetera. I mean, technically, if you want to move the needle one way or another, that's fine. But at the same time, I think his point's right. I mean, right now, Professor Badabiel, there is no pure form of economics, right? That exists in theory and not in practice.
That is correct. That is correct. And the caller is also right that if there even were to be a completely pure form of socialism or capitalism, it is unlikely that it would be sustainable for any length of time. The second point that the caller alluded to is, I think, the more significant one, what to do about poverty. I mean, we can go back to the Bukov.
You've got 20 seconds to solve it. Go ahead.
I'll give it my best shot. I think the question to ask is, what causes poverty? Once we begin to understand the causes of poverty, we begin to have a better handle on how to solve it. But until we have a good handle on that, all our answers are going to be hitting dartboards with a hit and miss dimension to them.
Well, again, this is just another example when we have a panel like this that we could spend both hours. We could spend the whole week on these subjects, but we're always grateful for the time provided by our panel. Jim Englert from High Falls Advisors, right around the corner. Thank you for taking the time, Jim.
Thank you for inviting me.
Amit Badabiel, Professor of Economics at RIT. Thank you, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Randy Stone from the Skolny Center for Polish and European Studies at the University of Rochester, among others. Randy, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Short break, and next hour, we meet some parents who are proud to send their kids to Rochester City Schools. They're responding to the Dust Up and Spence report over urban-suburban. That is next.